It's episode 106 of Dive in the Podcast with special guest Anesty Vega. Dive in the Podcast is a weekly all about diving podcast for everyone. Whether you explore the oceans as a snorkeler, scuba diver, free diver, or tech diver, Dive In has something for you. The show is filled with diving news, feature interviews with guests from around the world, interesting topics, and ocean advocacy. Visit diveinpod.com to find out more about the show, past guests, and our Patreon.
Hi, everyone. I'm Amit.
I'm Justin.
I'm Nick, and we're the hosts of Dive In the Podcast.
Before we get started today, we'd like to thank you, our listeners, for tuning in every week. Your support encourages us to keep going and make a bigger and better podcast. If you enjoy listening to this show, you can leave us a review on your podcast app of choice or at podchaser.com. Reviews are one of the best ways to help others find the podcast. Last week, we had Colin Hansen, the famed artist of Nova Scotia scuba tanks everywhere with all the nudibranch stickers and photographer and everything else that he does. It was a fun episode. Yeah, it was a good guy to have on. It was a nice chat. Me, April, and Colin had a good time and definitely look to see where his art and everything else goes in the future.
I've got a follow-up from our guests in episode 88, David Lee and Leanne. And during that episode, David Lee was talking about making a photo book about underwater photos called Jamaica Below the Surface. And one of my friends based in Grenada, who actually works as a publisher for a Caribbean sailing guide, she actually reached out to David Lee and offered to help him create the book. And just this past week, she went up to Jamaica, and David and Leanne hosted her, and they went diving and kind of explored Jamaica a little bit and been working on the book. So we're kind of excited to see a guest and a listener kind of get together and to collaborate on a project that was kind of mentioned on the show. And we hope that that collaboration is successful, and we really look forward to seeing the book Jamaica Below the Surface.
Yeah, that's pretty cool to see, actually. And yeah, when you pointed it out earlier, I was pretty stoked about the idea of it. And like you said, maybe we had just an itty tiny little bit of influence on that, right, Nick? Well, at least we'd like to think so.
We'll just take all the credit while we're at it.
That's awesome. Well, this week we have Anesty Vega on the show. We actually have a two-parter. Anesty is kind of a bit of a life. He has had a lot going on and a lot to talk about. It's going to be an interesting adventure. And our listeners are definitely going to be interested in what he has to say. On tonight's episode, we'll hear how a life fraught with overcoming obstacles gave way and meaning to diving. We'll hear about decolonizing scuba diving. And then on the next episode, we'll hear about his work as a citizen scuba scientist and a lot more. So let's get into it for this week's part one of the two-parter. Anesty Vega is an oceanographer, educator, and adventurer based in Florida and explores the oceans around the world. He also serves as a scuba instructor and expedition leader to advocate for our oceans and increase education, safety, and accessibility to scuba and ocean exploration. Welcome to the podcast, Anesty. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is an honor.
We're super happy to have you on. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing good. It's the end of the semester, so things are a little stressful, but you know, I'm going to be switching from survival mode into thrive mode here after next week into the summer.
I bet. And we'll officially start your interview in a couple minutes here, Anesty. But have you ever dove for lobster? There's a little lobster diving in Florida, right?
Recreationally? There is. There's mini lobster season where it's only open up for like a weekend, I believe. Mm-hmm. And then there's like a little bit of a longer season. I'm not entirely sure what those are. I'm not huge into harvesting too much. But I've been on boats where people have come up with, you know, 4, 5, 6 lobsters, and the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission is out there in full effect during those seasons, making sure everybody's like following those rules to a T. Yeah. And so that's my access to all that.
Well, that's definitely interesting. I've seen the videos of the mini lobster season. It can get a little hairy out there.
Yeah, that's, I don't even bother trying to get out on a boat, even if it's just a strictly scuba boat. Like, yeah, I'm taking that weekend off.
Awesome. Well, in case you missed it, it looks like New Hampshire may have dodged a bullet. No, I don't know, depending on your point of view. Their Senate has rejected a bill, House Bill 1297, that would have allowed scuba divers to catch lobster in the state's local waters. Opponents said that the divers may damage the environment and destroy lobster populations. While co-sponsor of the bill, Senator Kevin Avard, said, all this is doing is allowing a few scuba divers to grab a couple lobsters to bring home. They're not allowed to sell them. You gain revenue because there has to be a fee. This is something I know is near and dear to the Nova Scotia divers that a lot of us know, because there's huge lobster fisheries here commercially, but you can't touch any recreationally at all here. And so I know people have solicited the DFO, local DFO, Department of Fisheries and Oceans, and made requests, but they said there's plenty of other ways to catch sea life in Nova Scotia. That's a pretty direct quote. Anyway, what do you guys think?
What I find really interesting is that New Hampshire has like actually a really, really tiny coastline on the eastern seaboard.
Yeah, I don't know what the distance is, but they did quote that in an article that will be linked in our show notes, that they have a very short coastline and they need to keep it pristine, I guess.
It's one of those things where when politicians get involved, you have to ask yourself, are the decisions they're making science driven? Are they consulting with sustainable fisheries experts to be able to make the best decisions around what is accurate and realistic for, you know, that ecosystem? And so it sounds like they're more concerned with, it sounds like it's a decision based more in the ignorance of scuba diving as a whole, based on what you read so far, versus, the actual like science driven nature of what is sustainable, there in that upper northeast part, of America into Nova Scotia. But it's one of those things where you have to ask, like, what is the agenda? You know, where is the information coming from? What's the angle? And for the most part, these kinds of decisions by politicians, especially around limiting or excluding fisheries in some areas, are very disproportionately affecting indigenous communities. Even there in like Nova Scotia, like you said, it's near and dear to your heart. You know, if that starts to set a precedence and that starts to creep into other regions, including Nova Scotia, the Mi'kmaq people there, that have been, you know, fishing for fish and lobster and, you know, other, you know, sustainable sources of food and other resources in the ocean since time immemorial, are now disproportionately affected by a colonized system. And so I'm, you know, for the most part, I'm like, all right, we should follow the laws, because ideally I'd like to think that they're science driven.
Right.
And at the same time, you know, indigenous communities that aren't part of the problem are having to be forced to be part of this contrived solution in often cases.
Well, that's a much better and deeper point that I was going to make. I'm glad we had you here, Nessie, to go in on that. Well, awesome. Thank you for that viewpoint. That was great. Now that everyone's all caught up, it's time to actually dive in with Nessie Vega. So where are you from, Nessie?
Ethnically, I'm from Brazil. My family, my parents, my mother and my grandparents are from Brazil. I'm second generation born here in America. I was born in New Orleans and moved around a lot. I moved, my mom met a Greek guy, so my stepdad is Greek, and we moved to Greece for a little bit and then back to Brazil, and then lived in New York for like a year. That's where I learned how to speak English. So sometimes when I get a little upset, a New York accent comes out. Even though I was only there like a year, I don't claim New York by any means, but a little bit of a New York accent sometimes. Yeah. And then settled down most of my childhood in Florida, in the Tampa Bay area, and joined the Army after that, and then lived most of my adult life in California after the Army up until recently, where I relocated back to Florida for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah, we'll be getting to some of those reasons as we move on. But before that, I understand you didn't get into scuba diving until later in life. We want to explore a bit of your life before that point. Was there something that ultimately influenced that journey towards diving?
It was one of those things where, you know, to kind of tell that story, you got to go back a little ways. And so it really kind of is rooted in a childhood of turmoil. And you know, I won't get into too much detail because I'm not trying to make people cry or anything, but it was a rough childhood. I was homeless by the time I was 16. I was kicked out of my house for not wanting to drop out of school, ironically. And I lived in my car for like 5 months and then settled in with somebody, with a family friend. Mm-hmm. And was able to graduate high school on time, barely. And then I joined the Army. The Army was, you know, had that stability and that consistency that I was really craving in my life. And so I was like guaranteed paycheck, guaranteed roof over my head, guaranteed food to eat.
Yeah.
Doesn't get much better than that for the kind of situation I'm currently in. And so joined the Army. This was in 2000, before 9/11. Obviously, 9/11 happened about a year and a half later after I joined. I had already been deployed to Kosovo before that, and then deployed to Afghanistan shortly after 9/11. I was part of the invasion of Afghanistan, and I did two tours there altogether. I was hurt in my second tour and had to be medically reclassified. So just a lot of trauma, a lot of childhood trauma combined with military combat trauma. And like a lot of veterans post-service, I was struggling to find my purpose in life in the civilian world, trying to figure out what I was going to do with myself. You know, where can I make an impact? What can I do with my life? And so I had a bunch of like entry-level jobs. I had military service on my resume, so I basically got any entry-level job I applied to, essentially. I was everything from like a cashier at a convenience store to I was a chiropractic assistant at a doctor's office working with chiropractors. I was a manager at a carpet factory warehouse. I mean, just the most random stuff, like you name it. I was like a bouncer at a nightclub on the weekends, just random stuff and just no real direction in life. And like a lot of veterans, I was suffering from PTSD, obviously. And there's a stereotype of getting involved in a lot of adrenaline filled activities to kind of fill that void. And so I was involved in like motorcycle racing, MMA fighting, skydiving. And I thought my next big adventure was going to be diving with sharks. And so I walk into a scuba shop and I'm like, I want to go diving with sharks. And they're like, calm down. There's a couple of steps here, man. And so I got certified and just fell in love with it from there. I mean, it's really become an intrinsic part of my life. And it's as much as I pursued it, thinking it was going to be my next adrenaline fix, as much as it was a very calming, therapeutic, almost meditative practice in my life that helped kind of calm my mind and put me on the path to healing from PTSD.
It's very cool. So now we're going to chat a little bit more about that, I think, and some of those points in particular, but I want to roll back quite a bit in that story. And, you know, you mentioned obviously moving around quite a bit as a child, and I'm curious because I think this ties into a lot of things later on in life. But can you tell us how that moving helped you to develop your worldview?
It was one of those things where, especially settling down in a place like Florida, thankfully, like the Tampa Bay area, Hillsborough County is relatively on the progressive side, which isn't saying much considered it's nestled into the rest of Florida. But it was an interesting dynamic because I was being introduced to an environment of relative and collective closed-mindedness about things in a way. But because I had already like had my roots in understanding so many different cultures and that, you know, people are different on a global level, on a worldwide level between religion and gender and sexual identity and language and all these other factors that make us all unique in various ways. I was very much a rebel of that status quo thinking in that environment. And it actually ended up getting me in a lot of trouble. I've been pretty progressive, you know, for the bulk of my life. And I just was a black sheep in those communities growing up. And so that, you know, that was a big part to do with, you know, with the, you know, me not fitting in very well in my childhood. But now with, you know, with a lot of these political movements that are happening, a lot of these social justice movements that are happening, it's kind of bringing it full circle where like, I'm just kind of sitting back, you know, myself, you know, and a number of my colleagues are kind of sitting back going, man, we told y'all this is how it's supposed to be. This is what we knew was coming eventually. So it's really good to see it come full circle.
That's fantastic. Now, you mentioned earlier on that, you know, there were some difficult points in your childhood. We don't want to push too far there, but would you be willing to share any of those challenges and how you had to struggle to overcome those? I know, as an example, like you'd mentioned some time in foster care, and potentially what I'm looking at is, like, you know, how those experiences kind of influence your development, much like your traveling influenced your worldview.
It was kind of rough because, I mean, we can get really deep into it around, like, growing up thinking my stepdad was my real dad and not finding out till I was 23. That's a little thing to throw out there that gets really dicey and complex. But for the most part, my stepdad was an alcoholic who was physically abusive, very domineering, very controlling about the way he thought things were supposed to be and about his own culture and religion. So at the expense of learning more about, like, my other side of my identity and who I am. And then obviously for that, you know, dominance, like, I went to Greek school, I went to Greek church, I was baptized in the Greek church. Like, it was all just like my whole childhood was dominated by a culture that I found out later on wasn't even mine by blood. And it was kind of crazy, but even apart from, like, that identity crisis, it was just, you know, being brought up in a lot of physical abuse, witnessing a lot of domestic violence as well. And just having a disregard for education. My dad only made it to, like, the sixth grade. And that was something he kind of threw out there, like, he was proud of, because he was, like, this semi-successful businessman, you know, running a small business, you know, that made, you know, decent money. You know, and he was able to accomplish that and by only going to the sixth grade back in Greece, you know, and moving to a whole other country on the other side of the world to do what he's doing now, kind of painted this egotistical picture that education isn't important, that as long as you've got, like, intuitive smarts, then you'll be just fine. And my mom didn't graduate high school either. I think she went to, like, the ninth or 10th grade before dropping out. And so I just knew somehow, some way or another, I can't even really explain it. I've been asked this before, but I knew that education was going to be my ticket out of all of that turmoil and that I needed to stay in school. And that's why I was so stubborn and hardheaded about, I just need to finish my high school diploma and just figure out next steps from there. I think that, like, I didn't know exactly what it was going to be, but I knew that was going to be my next step. And so my stepdad was like, either you drop out of school and come to work for me full time or you find a new place to live. And so I got pushed out from there.
Coming from that, I guess you had you'd also described an interesting component in your life, and you kind of touched on it briefly here, but that period where you'd experienced homelessness, and I've heard you actually describe that time as, even though you were in a place where you're experiencing homelessness, you still felt that you were a person with some privilege. And I felt like that demonstrated a pretty high level of humility and self-awareness. So I was wondering if you could kind of explore a little bit why you viewed it that way.
I was in a place where I think if most other people were in that position, they wouldn't have been able to come out of it the way I did. And some of the circumstances that allowed me to be able to have the opportunity to bounce back from that. And one of those things was that I had a car. My parents owned an auto dealership. So before I got kicked out, like, I had a car. And it was one of those things where my parents gave me a car simply so that they didn't have to be burdened with needing to pick me up from home or from school to bring me to the shop to go work for them after school. It was just a matter of convenience for them. But I still had a car nonetheless, nothing to downplay by any means. And so that helped tremendously because I slept in my car for the first 5 months after getting kicked out. And it wasn't super consistent. There'd be like a weekend here and there, a week or here and there, where I'd stay at, like, my godmother's on the other side of, you know, the bay, or crash with a friend whose parents were out of town. And, you know, and so oftentimes I'd wake up, I'd have an alarm set and wake up and then drive over to my friend's house down the street, wait for his parents to leave for work and hop in the shower before trying to get to school on time. You know, stuff like that. So I had, you know, it forced me to be resourceful is really what it came down to. And that's the silver lining to it all. It helped me grow up really fast. It helped me develop a sense of maturity around being self-sufficient, you know, as a young person, and being very analytical, with a lot of critical thinking around what do I have access to? What can I do to help this situation be as good as it can be? And be very accepting of the thing that, you know, that like shit has hit the fan. Okay. What do I do about it now? And that was really helpful in being, you know, staying alive in the army and in combat. You know, there's people who, when bullets start flying and the shit hits the fan, it's like either you can get hyper focused on what next steps are, or you just break down and become unusable and freeze. And so, thankfully, I had a childhood that prepared me for combat for better or worse. And so it was, you know, that's what I try to do, is just find the silver linings, just try to find ways that, like, accepting where things are and not being burdened by the circumstances, so that I can focus on, you know, the resources I have access to achieve the best possible outcome.
We're going to take a short service interval and we'll be right back with more from Anesty Vague.
This episode of Dive In the Podcast is brought to you by Torpedo Rays Scuba.
You can find them online at torpedorays.com.
They've been teaching Canada how to dive for 25 years and are a proud sponsor of this podcast.
If you're in Atlantic Canada and want to take a course or see the shop, stop in and see us in Dartmouth and check out the huge selection of scuba, apnea, surf gear, and much more.
Dive tours are available for locals and visitors to experience all that our ocean playground has to offer.
TorpedoRays.com has a vast selection of dive gear at unbeatable prices, with free shipping available in Canada and quick shipping throughout North America.
So visit TorpedoRays.com or stop in the shop and you might even see one of us there.
If you'd like to win a Dive In the Podcast decal and a chance to win an awesome hoodie from us at the end of the year, send us a voice message via our voicemail button at diveinpod.com and answer your favorite guest question. What keeps you diving? Messages must be no longer than 30 seconds. We'll pick a favorite and play it in the next episode.
I was just wondering, when you mentioned your military career, would you say that without that career, there might not be the Anesty Vague that's talking with us today? Would you agree with that statement?
I do. It helped me reestablish a sense of self-esteem that I didn't really have growing up, especially with the kind of like emotional and verbal abuse that I was growing up with, like just thinking I was scum of the earth and that I wasn't amounting to anything. And I mean, the drill sergeants didn't help make that much better in the beginning, but being able to graduate from infantry school and airborne school and accomplish all the things that I did, and being able to come back from atrocious situations and be alive and still have my 10 fingers, 10 toes, and my head still on my shoulders, you know, is something that really helps build, like, all right, like if I can survive through that, I can survive through just about anything. And it really helped build my sense of self-esteem, like I said, and also like a sense of like ambition to be able to, like, all right, I've got some good skills under myself to, you know, to be able to build myself out. And so I leveraged that as best I could in the civilian world. And I reflect back on it in a lot of ways, especially being from an Indigenous background. It's like, you know, to reconcile that identity as both a military veteran and as an Indigenous person is, it gets interesting. And it's still something I struggle with to this day. But at the end of the day, the Army helped reestablish myself as a person and establish my own individual identity away from my family, away from the circumstances of my childhood, to be able to say, like, I can do this on my own, and I have done this on my own, and I'm going to continue to do so. So, you know, as much as I struggle with, you know, the things that I have gone through in the military and the traumas and all the political sort of rhetoric behind, you know, military service and how that's called co-opted, at the end of the day, it's really given me a lot to build off of and to really find myself away from, you know, the path that was originally set out for me.
I mean, all that turmoil, or I guess emotional cost in the military, how did that ultimately impact you?
It was one of those things where, especially by my second tour in Afghanistan, you know, the whole idea, like, you know, if you're old enough to remember it, there was after 9/11, it was like this huge wave of patriotism and blind nationalism about America's number one, and we got to go get those terrorists, and we got to find Osama bin Laden. And I found myself in the like seeing that stuff back home in between deployments, and then being able to go to Afghanistan and go, I haven't seen one shred of Al Qaeda or Osama bin Laden out here. We're just finding like and having to fight like random Taliban units that are like way more disorganized than we ever cared to imagine. You know, I mean, we got into some dicey stuff. Don't get me wrong. The Taliban can pack a punch, but it wasn't anything like the propaganda I saw back home. And that started to really do a number on me about like what the real reasons were, why we were there, especially by my second tour. We were babysitting like Halliburton people building the OPEC pipeline. And, you know, it was like, this is what we're here for, you know? And it just made me start to really question that nationalism that you get brainwashed about, not just as an American, but as a soldier, especially right from day one, that, you know, made me second guess like what this was all for and why we're doing it. And just came to the conclusion that we were just really being lied to in a number of ways about the justifications for that war and for everything else that America's doing overseas. And that just pushed me to be more radically progressive around like understanding that there's not any real difference between American or Afghan or Iranian or anybody else around the world, because it pushing back against that propaganda helped me reinstill a sense of humanity for myself and for all people. And that's what's really been driving me ever since. And that goes against the grain about what the military community looks like in a lot of ways. But what is interesting is that like the conservative politics that exists out there has co-opted the veteran community in a lot of ways, you know, and saying like, oh, don't kneel for the flag. That's disrespectful to the veteran community. And I'm sitting there going, no, it's not. Like, you know, it's a nonviolent protest, which everybody's entitled to. And it's theoretically, it's what I fought for the ability for any American to be able to do that and protest, you know, nonviolently. And in this case around police brutality. And so don't speak for us. Don't do that. The Conservative Party kind of co-opts that veteran community to be able to speak for us and kind of use us as a tool and leverage in some way. And there's a growing number of us in the veteran community who served and, you know, for various reasons going, no, that's what we fought for. You need to stop that right now. And we're not wanting to aid in this political divide we're in any way, shape or form.
I understand you pursued filmmaking after the military. What made you decide to take up filmmaking?
That's an interesting kind of turn of events. It was one of those things where, you know, in that time of not having any much direction in my life, one thing was for sure, I enjoyed the martial arts. I studied the martial arts since I was 12, trained with a few people through high school, and then continued that training in other ways through the military. And then when I got out, you know, I reconnected with a childhood friend of mine from high school, and he had a martial arts school. And so I started training with him again. And it was a culmination of a few things. It was some new innovative films coming out of Thailand with Tony Jaa called Ong Bak and The Protector, if you guys are familiar with that. And also around 2005 was the advent of YouTube, where it was really common, you know, to make your own videos and share them on the internet. And so the owner of the school, Maurice, was like, hey, you're good with computers, right? And I'm like, sure. He's like, hey, why don't you bring your video camera tomorrow and let's shoot some stuff. And I'm like, that's not the same thing, but okay, we'll figure it out. And so we had some live demos that we would choreograph and perform for like, you know, local community events like Santa Fest or something like that to help promote the martial arts school. But we started, you know, kind of putting together our own little mini fight scenes with like no storyline, no justification about why we're beating each other up. It was just, let's show off some skills. It was just, you know, a showcase of different moves and transitions and choreography. And so we started to put that together, and it started to get like pretty popular. People love to see that kind of stuff on the internet. And so, you know, it kind of like it wasn't like a passion of mine, like that I pursued, but it just kind of like just casually kind of fell into my lap. And I started, you know, I was like, all right, if I'm going to do this, I want to be really good at it. So I started studying a lot of online resources. And that was a time where like experts were sharing all their information for free on the internet. And they still do that now, but now there's master classes too, where they want to charge you $1,500 for a 9-session master class online. But this was a time where like everybody was sharing anything and everything on the internet. So I got to learn how to be a filmmaker while watching other videos, ironically. And, you know, and it was mostly through like, you know, martial arts, fight choreography, you know, started tapping into other local resources, started choreographing fight scenes for some student films, and just kind of like, you know, just thought that that's, you know, like, all right, well, this seems easy and this path is opening up for me. And it wasn't, like I said, it wasn't anything that I pursued. It was just something that was presented to me that I pursued for a time until it didn't work out anymore.
One of their films, A Spaniard's Tale, won award action on the, with the Actions Film Challenge. What's the synopsis of that film?
That was, I've always loved the ocean. This is long before I was even a scuba diver, but I loved growing up and hearing of like the pirate lore around Florida, around Jose Gaspar. That's why we have like Gasparilla. It's an annual parade, similar to like Mardi Gras. There's lots of beads and other, you know, proclivities around, you know, sharing beads in a parade. And, it was just a lot of fun. And so, when it came time to participate, I came up with a story idea that, and this was a bit fantasy of, on my own part, that my main character was a long-lost descendant of Jose Gaspar, and that his grandmother shared with him a story around where his long-lost treasure might be hidden. And so he goes on pursuit of finding, of looking for this treasure, and runs into some bad guys that kind of sort of know about the treasure, but just kind of caught wind that that's his pursuit and are trying to beat him to it. So that helps justify, you know, that conflict between a boat chase, a fight scene on the docks, a fight scene on the beaches, even an underwater fight scene that I shot with a GoPro. And that was interesting because I got my hands on a GoPro earlier that year. This was 2010. And the very first HD Hero that shot in HD video was released in like December the year before, in like 2009. GoPro had been around since like 2004, but this was the first like HD camera. And the second I saw it, I was like, I got to have one. I don't know what I'm going to shoot with it or what I'm going to use it for. I just want one. And so I got it and I just held it. And just having one of those things, like such an innovative piece of equipment, you know, that's relatively small and inexpensive, that can do so much, that can open up a whole new world underwater, was like really inspiring. And I was like, I just looked at my friend the second I unboxed it and I was like, underwater fight scene. He's like, absolutely. And so that's what drove that storyline. And I'm like, all right, what kind of storyline can I have that justifies an underwater fight scene? And so that's how A Spaniard's Tale was built out. And it was the very first like cinematic type scene, especially an underwater fight scene of all things, that was shot on a GoPro that I know of. And GoPro found out about it and reached out to me. I was like, hey, did you shoot this scene? We're like, yeah. Like, oh, we want to sponsor you. So I became for like 2 or 3 years a sponsored GoPro filmmaker. And it was kind of a wild ride. And they sent me like the GoPro 2 and 3. And I think by the time the 3 came out, they started to kind of dip into the red a little bit and they cut a lot of their sponsorships. And so I was dropped from there. But that was fun times.
That's interesting. So did you say like the filmmaking and the diving came first for you?
Filmmaking, and then we shot an underwater fight scene. That was free diving. That wasn't even on scuba. I wasn't even scuba certified until I started in 2012 and finished at the very beginning of 2013. And so that didn't come until like 2 years later. The underwater fight scene took place in like the shallows out in this open water of the bay. But we actually cheated those underwater shots to a place called Alafaya Springs, which only goes to like 12, 15 feet. And so, and this was the GoPro 1, mind you, that didn't have a screen on the back. So you had no idea what you were shooting, but it opened up so wide that like you just pointed it in the general direction of what you wanted to shoot and hope for the best. And so we'd be like, we strategically mapped out the fight scene by segment and by angle. So we're like, all right, segment 1, angle 1. And we'd be like, 1, 2, 3. And we dropped down and I didn't even have a weight belt yet. So I had my assistant camera guy literally just kind of step on me at the surface to keep me down for like a good 30 or 45 seconds as I filmed like these other two guys drop down and do, you know, the movements of segment 1, angle 1. And then we're like, all right, segment 1, angle 2. and then segment two, angle one. And we just kind of, we had a shot list, you know, very organized, very strategic, and it all came together fairly well in the editing process, thankfully. But luckily we got multiple shots, multiple cuts of each angle, each segment, and knew we needed to get as much coverage as possible, but we had all day. Weirdly, when we went out there to Alafaya Springs, we were like, oh, there's only going to be like a handful of people. We'll go on a Sunday. It'll be kind of chill. And I was so focused on the film, we're deep in this film, that I had no clue that it was Father's Day. And I was already a father too. And I was like, I didn't know it was Father's Day. And we go out there and there's like 20,000 people. And so in editing, we had to like digitally like paint out people's legs out of the background, you know, kind of like just floating along the background as like this fight scene is supposed to be happening in the open water.
That's funny. That's awesome.
So now I want to go back, as you said, so the filmmaking came first and then, you know, eventually led you to diving. And you had mentioned this little piece. I think we have a connection there because you had said that your interest in scuba diving started with sharks. And I would say that it was the same kind of thing with me. So what was it about diving with sharks that interested you so much to inspire you to become a scuba diver?
Sharks just seemed to be, like I said, I was just really focused on like getting my adrenaline up, anything that got the blood pumping, anything that, you know, just seemed exhilarating. And so, you know, when you watch Shark Week on the Discovery Channel, it's all the highlights of like, you know, these very flashpoint moments of like a shark turning into you, or, you know, even if you're in a cage, you know, like out at like Guadalupe Island off of Mexico, it's like, you know, you see these, just these highlights and Shark Week does a great job of showing you those intense moments, thinking that that's what scuba diving looks like. That was the representation of what scuba diving was for me, you know, through media. And so that's what I was looking to pursue. And that's where my mindset was like, this is going to get my adrenaline pumping. And then I'm sitting, you know, a week later, actually, when I walked into a shop and I said all that, and they were like, all right, there's a few steps, you know, there's some training involved and you got to get gear and all that stuff. And I was like, all right, well, tell me how much it all costs. And they're like, all right, well, the BCD and reg comes with the class, but you know, you're going to need your mask, snorkel, fins, boots, you know, wetsuit, weights and all that stuff, plus the cost of the training and all that stuff. So, you know, you're looking at about this price. And I'm like, okay, I'll be back in February when I get my tax return to be able to afford all this.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure if you guys have like how taxes work in Canada, but that's pretty much when the poor people are like, you know, semi-rich in February, March, when they file their tax returns and they get like $1,800. And so, you know, $2,000 depending on, you know, their paycheck throughout the year and all that. But it was either a scuba diving course or like, you know, putting 22-inch chrome rims on my donk. And do you guys know what a donk is? You guys don't know what a donk is, do you?
I don't know.
You should Google that real fast.
Donk.
A donk is like, so it's like older cars, especially like in my generation, it's like older like Chevy Caprices or Monte Carlos that were like lifted on like these ridiculous 22-inch, 24-inch rims. It's
okay.
It was a whole thing, especially here in Florida. And so it was either a donk or scuba diving. So I'm like, I'll go with scuba diving.
I mean, we're obviously talking to you on Dive in the Podcast many years after that decision. Was there a moment either on your first scuba dive or at some point afterwards where you went, yeah, this is it for me? Or and what did that mean to you? Like, did you have an aha moment?
The aha moment was doing hover in the pool. Most open water training agencies like Patty now, he has like a hover component, which really focuses on neutral buoyancy, as it should. Some instructors and or agencies focus on it more than others. But for me, that was really the aha moment because, and maybe it was more impactful because I was looking for adrenaline and what I got was like peace and calm and something that I wasn't expecting nor looking for. And to kind of back things up a little bit, when it came to PTSD, I knew in some way, shape or form that like I had a problem, but I talked myself into thinking I didn't have a problem for some time. You know, I was like, all right, I came back from the military with my head on my shoulders, 10 fingers, 10 toes. Physically, I'm good, so I'm good. And that's it. There wasn't a lot of focus on mental health. in the military or in the civilian world shortly after. And so it was one of those things where like I didn't have a name for it, but I knew something was wrong. I knew something about me and how I changed through all of that, changed how I interacted with people, how I reacted to normal situations in life that didn't seem normal. That kind of seemed to put me at odds with a lot of things and a lot of people in my life, and still sometimes does, honestly. It's still a thing that I struggle with, honestly. But I knew that I wanted to try and find some semblance of peace in my life to just kind of calm down all this white noise in my head where I'm having like 1,000 thoughts a minute. And so even through like my martial arts training, I'd be in Thailand or the Philippines and go to like these Buddhist temples and these meditative practices, you know, the meditative components that are attached to martial arts styles throughout the world, and in pursuit of that peace. So like, I wasn't really acknowledging it, but I knew deep down inside, especially in retrospect, like obviously I was looking for something to kind of calm my mind, and nothing seemed to work. I would walk out of a meditative session for like 4 hours straight, and they'd be like, "Oh man, that was so transformative. I feel so good." Like, "Anesti, how you feel?" And I'm like, "My ankles hurt from sitting weird for 4 hours straight." But yeah, I mean, I'm chill. But for the most part, my attempt to clear my mind of all thoughts was just kind of unsuccessful, honestly. But when it came to scuba diving, which is a place that I had no idea that I was going to find that peace that I was looking for elsewhere, was that instead of clearing my mind of all thoughts, I became hyper-focused on my breathing. And being able to see that, like, you know, once I got my BCD dialed in, it was just a matter of inhaling and kind of rising up in the water column and exhaling and kind of writing down. And I'm a perfectionist in a lot of ways. And so I wanted to make sure that I was good at neutral buoyancy. My instructor was amazing. And she was super patient with me because I was a terrible student. I was all over the place. I was not mentally or physically prepared for open water training. I was just like, come on, just don't want to get this over with so I can go dive in the ocean already. I was a terrible student, but she was amazing. And she really honed in on like neutral buoyancy is make or break for what is considered a good scuba diver, you know? And so I was like, all right, this is the one skill I definitely got to get down. And it caused me to kind of focus in. And once I became hyper-focused on one singular thought, instead of trying to clear my mind completely and just trying to be devoid of all thoughts, is where that meditative peace and calm for me started to come into play and pushed all that white noise to the back of my mind and gave me a glimpse of what my mind could look like without PTSD, without these racing thoughts, without all these distractions in my head about all these other things, and allowed me to just kind of be present in the moment. And that was really my aha moment that I've been craving getting back to ever since.
Yeah. I mean, I think most divers can appreciate that. Sorry. I was lost in a trance of thinking about diving and floating around in the water as you were going through that.
I get that a lot. I tell that story and people kind of start to revisualize themselves back in neutral buoyancy, yeah. kind of just like, oh, it's just so meditative, you know, for me and for so many other people.
Most definitely. That does it for today's part one of our two-part series with Anesti Vega. It was a pleasure chatting with him, and just wait till you see what he's got in store for us in 2 weeks on the next episode. You've been listening to Dive in the Podcast. I'm Justin.
I'm Nick.
I'm Amit.
Don't forget, you can support this podcast at patreon.com/diveinpod and get some fun rewards for doing so. Visit our website, diveinpod.com, for all the links you need, episodes, merch, and even connect with us on social media.
This episode of Dive in the Podcast was brought to you by our sponsor, Torpedo Rays Scuba.
Thanks for listening.